Welcome to Steppin' Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Everybody, my name's Sue Supriano, and I am at the North American Street Newspaper Association Conference, which is happening here in San Francisco at the end of July in the year 2001. And I'm going to be speaking here with Tom Boland, who's from Boston. He's been involved in movement things for many years, starting in the 60s, right?
Yes, Tom? That's true.
And most recently, you're doing a newswire online for that's only for homeless people. That's specifically for homeless people. And well, let's kind of focus on media and what's happening in Boston, or what you're involved in anyway.
First, let me say that it's a discussion list online which has archived articles that the street newspapers use, and the only people who can post articles there are people who are currently or formerly homeless. The aim of this setup is to have an uncensored voice for those who are drowned out by the conversation on social policy that corporations dominate through various institutions. And we have found a sort of cultural imperialism, even within the progressive movement on occasion, of people speaking for us. So we just got angry and decided we would start speaking for ourselves, mm-hmm. using the internet as a tool.
Mm-hmm. Are you homeless yourself?
I'm not homeless now, but I spent over 2 years homeless, a little part of the time in San Francisco, actually, back in 1970, mostly in the 60s and early 70s. I was homeless.
Well, from my point of view, I wouldn't want to be homeless, I'll tell you that. It sounds really very difficult, and there's, of course, such a growing number of people who don't have any other options.
That's a moral outrage in the world's richest country. For sure, fear is probably a dominant emotion among homeless people, because we often don't know whether we're going to be stabbed or shot by a cop or stabbed by a mugger or whatever. So safety is an incredibly important issue to homeless people, and I feel like all people on this planet deserve secure shelter, and I want to work in my own backyard to, you know, get justice here around housing access.
So tell me something more about that work, more about the discussion list and the other things that you're doing, Tom Boland.
Okay. In 1997, Homeless People's Network started a discussion list online. We had noticed that service providers were dominating the policy frame about homelessness, along with the media, and that homeless people were being portrayed as the cause of their own homelessness. Through some personal deficit, perceived personal deficit. It was commonly said by shelter providers, homeless people are mentally ill, homeless people are addicts. You have to solve their personal problems. But when the rents go up 4 to 6 times in 20 years, you know, more than quadrupled in Boston, for instance, you're going to have a lot more homeless people, no matter how emotionally stressed they are.
So you facilitate this discussion list, and tell me more about that. Are there many, many people involved, and how does it fit with the newspapers that are put out by homeless people?
I facilitate in the sense of being sort of a switchboard operator for those who wish to communicate with each other on homelessness issues who have been homeless. And there are people who have been homeless who are members of a few score of groups that can keep in contact through this list. A number of people are involved with Food Not Bombs, Homes Not Jails, various member chapters of the National Coalition on Homelessness, various street papers, have staff who have been homeless that are on this list. So the street papers can look at our approximately 10 articles a day, 300 articles a month, and they can pick the 1 to 30 articles they want to publish in their issue, and they can choose their own foci on what to cover. They might have a theme, and from those articles, just like with AP, they can pick and choose. And so what enthuses me coming here in part is to see all those papers which have taken some content from there, and the fact that there's a much greater consciousness that gentrification, for instance, and police sweeps are happening everywhere on a very similar pattern, so that people realize they're not alone. And then if there's a struggle, people in Boston can talk with people in Kyoto about what worked in their various communities when, say, the police come down to clear out the squats and the encampments. So there's instant advice, instant support, and I'd say in a few cases there might have been some pressure placed locally by way of mostly national or international expressions of concern, people who would see those information about a local struggle might write to the mayor and say, hey, I'm a rabbi from Jerusalem and I'm really upset about what you're doing with homeless people in Santa Cruz or in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. So it gives us some power and credibility to have our own discussion and our own voice within the street newspaper movement and also within the national movement for housing justice. There have been people demanding for most of two decades that homeless people have our own voice, and we're beginning to get it.
Well, that's really wonderful. And you said international, too. You're connected in internationally. Of course, there's homeless people all over the world. And the United States is one of the few places where there weren't so many until when? How long has it been that there's been this, like, huge growing population of homeless people in the United States? I realize a lot of young people don't know it wasn't quite always like this.
We're international in the sense that the internet can go anywhere around the world where people can get online. But most of the people who read our list are from the U.S. and Canada, although there's a few other countries too. The spike in homelessness that I'm aware of started in the 80s, about 20 years after deinstitutionalization. So obviously deinstitutionalization didn't have a 20-year lag in causing homelessness.
And deinstitutionalization means shutting down mental hospitals?
Yes. It's been social policy for centuries to isolate the poor through ghettos, through poorhouses, through prisons, through shelters. We're really carrying on a policy of punishing people for their own poverty. That's what the social policy is, pretty much. And in a sense, killing them if necessary or letting them die.
Mm-hmm. So you said that you also have been, you started a homeless shelter, and there's other things that you've been doing in Boston.
Well, I think the shelter industry are corporate lapdogs, and I would never personally start a shelter. What we have in Boston is a self-advocacy center for homeless people. It's actually in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is adjacent to Boston. That center is 11 years old. It's completely staffed by homeless people, and we have showers and lockers and couches to sleep on and computers and telephones and storage space and free clothing and a lot of meetings when we're trying to get the attention of the powers that be around the plight of people who are homeless now.
In your opinion, are a lot of people getting more politicized than they were before? Because I know homelessness, that there's just very many different kinds of people who end up on the streets for various kinds of reasons, mostly not having money.
It's my cherished hope that people are getting more political. I think so, but I fooled myself over the decades, constantly thinking, well, the next big surge in justice activity is coming again, like it did when I was a college student in the 60s and 70s. There was certainly a surge then. I am incredibly enthused by the people I meet who are in their late teens and early 20s who have a critique of class oppression and who have loving hearts and bright minds and are ready to do nonviolent action for justice. They're connecting the issues much better, this younger generation, than mine did. So I'd say, yes, there is a growing movement. I think since Seattle, that's the time when young people began coming in. I got the chance to speak about a dozen times at universities this year in the area where I organize, in the Boston area, and the students were just so enthused. Some of them took over the administration building at Harvard to demand a living wage for their janitors and other workers. For 3 weeks, they occupied the building. There was a tent city outside with about 90 tents. There were demonstrations with a couple thousand people. At the peak moments, the police were very, very nervous, and they Harvard agreed to have discussions about a living wage. I thought that was not enough reason for people to walk out, but I wasn't one of those who was in the building risking expulsion and arrest. There was some civil disobedience going on in support of that building occupation, which put the administration on alert that people were serious about narrowing the wage-rent gap in Cambridge and holding its biggest employer accountable. That employer is Harvard University.
It's very interesting to hear your response, that's for sure. And I specifically wanted maybe my question wasn't clear enough, about the people who are homeless also being politicized in a way just by that experience that they weren't the kind of like, you know, thinking about things they never thought about before and understanding this system that you're referring to that I agree with.
I'm not sure that I could say that homeless people are more politicized now than they were 15 years ago in the area where I organize. In the mid-80s, we did a number of building takeovers and occupations of land to call for affordable housing and to hold accountable those institutions which were displacing people to create affordable housing for those people that they had displaced. At MIT, for instance, in 1987, we occupied the campus for 33 days to demand that their development plans be scrapped or restructured in such a way as not to continue displacing a lot of poor people from Cambridge. So we had more direct action and more fervor, I think, in the mid to late 80s. There was a group, the National Union of the Homeless, that was helping mobilize people. Also, Community for Creative Nonviolence, Housing Now. There were groups that were mobilized then, and there's less national mobilization and less direct action in Boston than there was in the late 80s. Many of those of us who were civil disobedience activists in those time ended up working for nonprofits and following the money and becoming complicitors in the isolation of the poor, in the blaming of the poor, in the policing of the poor. So many of those activists, in a sense, were bought off by paychecks and were silenced. The group that I helped form is now HUD-funded. That federal money makes it much less likely that Bread and Jams, collective, will criticize the government. Harvard University gave us a van and some money over time. So why criticize Harvard about displacement when you're getting free bagels, peanuts?
Yeah.
So I think the movement actually has muted some, but I think it might be building again among homeless people locally.
Yeah, that money issue, I agree. It's really a hard one because people need money, but as soon as I've noticed it many times, as soon as money becomes involved, it definitely changes the dynamics for these obvious reasons that you're talking about. My guest is Tom Bolin, who's from Boston, and we are here at the North American Street Newspaper Association Conference in San Francisco, and he's involved with a discussion list and many other on the internet and many other activities around homelessness and things related. And I wanted to ask you to say a little bit more about what you mean about shelters being the lapdogs of capitalism. Is that a correct quote?
I think I said shelters were lapdogs of the corporate elite, so that would be the same thing. Homeless people don't need shelters. We need income. We need civil rights. We need housing. If you ask homeless people what they want, they don't say, put me in a warehouse with another 200 people sleeping on cots. Mm-hmm. People don't ask for that. They take that, maybe if it's their only alternative. The people who don't go to the shelters are often called mentally ill because they don't want the chain of command. They don't want the boot heel on their neck from people who feel better than they are because their prospects economically are better at the moment. So the shelter industry has basically apologized for social control of the poor in order to get a funding stream from mainly from HUD is the biggest stream. That's the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Mm-hmm. But that's, of course, HUD is the government, not the... Well, I know you're going to have something to say about this. I could say it myself, but do go on, because it's the government, it's not the corporations.
Well, I mean, let me talk a little more about my critique of the shelters. Also, shelter providers decided to represent homeless people among policymakers, and they were really representing their own paychecks, saying, you should give us money to warehouse these people. They're mentally ill. They can't make it on their own. They're genetically defective, they're criminal, they're lazy, they have personal deficits just like people of color, just like women, just like Poles, just like Irish. All these stereotypes have been recycled. In fact, they said the same thing about the Egyptian slaves, about the Greek and Roman slaves. When you have an underclass, the overclass creates a reason to justify their control. And now we have more social control of homeless people, shelters cooperating with police to get homeless people arrested. And for me, I'm outraged that anyone with that agenda would say they're speaking for me.
Is it the same in Boston, speaking of police, as it is in San Francisco, where homeless people are arrested? In San Francisco, they get people's stuff and throw it into the garbage, into dumpsters, and arrest people. And even in Berkeley, more or less, almost the most progressive place in the United States, which is where I live, and some of the things that the police are doing to homeless people are just unconscionable, because you have to be able to sleep somewhere sometime. I mean, there's just, you know, we all humans have certain basic needs.
I think the homeless people in the San Francisco Bay Area have it much worse than in the Boston area. A few years ago, it wasn't as different. Homeless people in Boston and Cambridge, which is the town I know best, were being rounded up by the police. Their belongings were being thrown away. They were being arrested for nuisance crimes such as sleeping in public or panhandling. Then the ACLU brought a case against the city of Cambridge police for arresting panhandlers, and the state Supreme Judicial Court, the highest court in the state of Massachusetts, ruled the loitering laws unconstitutional and asserted that all people have the right to ask for help in need, that all people have free speech rights, and that includes homeless people who are asking for money or anyone else who is asking for money. So the police backed down because the ACLU had been winning millions of dollars in settlements in other cities around similar issues. And so now in the state of Massachusetts, homeless people are far less harassed by police, but they'll still find some reason, such as an open beer bottle or something, sleeping on private property. It's not as bad, though. San Francisco, I was here in 1995 for the Food Not Bombs International gathering, and the police were so harsh. They had fear and hatred in their eyes. They reminded me of the Vietnam War resistance. They seemed ready to go off. That was my visceral feeling. I was frightened. I don't feel that as often in the Boston area. Police I talk with and know me by name, and they might not like my politics, but I don't expect them to be beating me up in the alley. I would worry about that more here.
Interesting. What about Canada? You said, do you know something about other parts of the United States and Canada? I'd like to hear, since you are involved in this discussion list that you said is mostly related to in the United States and Canada.
Right. Some of the people who subscribe to the Homeless People's Network discussion list are from Canada. Maybe an eighth of the subscribers. It's hard to know. A lot are in Toronto, for instance. Toronto has adapted the policies that were developed in New York City, broken windows, policing, zero tolerance, nuisance crimes, where the developers decided that they could cash in on the downtown if they could drive out the poor, and that the way to do that was to use the police as a wedge. And combined with zoning variances and cronyism, they were able to push out poor people from certain areas and raise up the high-rises, pocket the money, and let the poor mothers cry.
So, and what about other countries besides the United States?
Well, in all over the world, there are people squatting. The UN has varied estimates of from 200,000 to a billion people who are squatting out of 6 billion on the planet, 6 billion plus. So that's up to a sixth of the people have no structure that we would even call a house in the United States. In Johannesburg, South Africa, a lot of homeless people are being pushed out by the new government and disappointing a lot of the progressives there. In Bolivia, there's a landless peasants movement, also in some other South American countries, Brazil, I think Guatemala as well. Peasants are mobilizing for land. Palestinians have been displaced from their land in the Middle East, and their communities are burned down for political reasons fairly routinely. War has displaced many, many, many millions of people. If you want homelessness, have a war. That would be my, and if you like prostitution and drugs, have a war. They really help assist in those aims. In Kyoto, Japan, no, I'm sorry, Osaka, Japan, we have some people on the list from there. They're bidding for the Olympics, as is Toronto and some other towns. And they've been sweeping the homeless people out of the business district because they want to win the Olympic bid. That may have been settled recently. Beijing, I think, also was bidding for it. And also in China, I've read, in mainland China, I have read that homeless people are displaced. In Russia, homeless people are rounded up in some cases. So wherever you have a concentration of power and wealth, whatever name the government gives itself, you're going to have the poor people screwed. And it seems to continually happen. Asia has many poor people. India, an example. Indonesia.
I'm so glad that I asked that question and that you answered it in the way that you have, because it's kind of obvious now that you answer it, but yet the whole way that we talk about homelessness, use that word in the United States like it's this particular thing, and of course it is everywhere. And the proportion of people that you're saying in the world that are dealing with not having places to live is really incredible. And of course, most people, I mean, here am I, you know, a radical activist, a radio person, and I kind of don't get it in the way that you were just explaining it, that those connections. And of course, most people don't think of it in that way. And in the very few remaining minutes, maybe you'd like to say something about that, Tom Boland, which I'm sure has to do with the way it's presented or not presented in the corporate media.
Well, I think the media frame has a lot to do with how people see homelessness, including how progressives like us see homelessness, people who are aiming to decrease wealth and power gaps. Because of the media, most people see it in personal terms. They don't see it in terms of a global economy that you have poverty. And then it's hard to figure out what to do about it if you do come up with the conclusion that corporate domination of civic policy worldwide is a key root of our problems here in San Francisco or in Boston. What do you do next? There's the money flow affecting our analysis. If I could get a job in Washington for $60,000 a year pressing for some legislation, I might mute my criticisms of many, many entities, many nonprofits, many government entities, maybe corporate entities, in order to increase the odds of winning allies to push through some little Band-Aid on the cancer. So it's very, very easy for people to be sidetracked and to lose sight of the big picture. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping that the generation that's 35 years younger than me and coming up now as activists will hold our feet to the fire, those of us who describe ourselves as aging activists.
Well, Tom Boland, thank you very, very much. Would you like to give any kind of contact for yourself or the organizations that you're involved with for if people want to tune in, get a hold of you?
Yes, the best way would be to email me. So if you'll get a pencil, I'll give you that email address. The address is WGCP at earthlink.net. That's really the best way to contact me. And then if you were interested in any particular group or campaign, there's the possibility I'd be able to link you up if you'd email me. Also, if you go online and you use a search engine for Homeless People's Network, just write that into a search engine and you'll probably find our site.
Okay. Homeless People's Network. Well, Tom Boland, thank you very, very much for this interview. I'm glad that we had a chance to do it, and I wish you the best in the future.
Well, thank you for giving me a chance to express my personal views.
My name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening.